From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From Washington's point of view, victory in Afghanistan was a spectacular success, quick, decisive, and clean. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld calls Afghanistan a breathtaking achievement. And now, many in Washington want to take that achievement to Iraq. Hawks circling the White House call U.S. military strategy in Afghanistan a model for war in Iraq. American supremacy in the air, along with a proxy war fought by local allies on the ground, some say, will bring down Baghdad and bring in the regime change the Bush administration has called for. Not true, says our guest tonight. Iraq is a larger hornet's nest of complications. It's bigger. It's better prepared. Saddam's opponents are weaker and divided. It's a different war altogether. And if Washington wants to fight a war with Baghdad, it will have to be prepared for an Iraq-sized war with Iraq-sized consequences. Listeners, is the war in Afghanistan a useful model for war in Iraq? Will ousting Saddam Hussein be as easy as ousting the Taliban? Is America ready to take on a war in Iraq? Is now the time to act? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. is Michael Donovan, research analyst and member of the Terrorism Project at the Center for Defense Information. Good evening and welcome, Michael Donovan.
Well, good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Michael Donovan, there's a lot of talk about the Afghanistan model in Washington these days and for the past several months. Why is this so popular with advocates of war with Iraq?
Well, I think that you summed it up nicely in your introduction, that they see Afghanistan as a very clean, quick, and dramatic achievement. And they're half right. The military campaign in Afghanistan was a clean, quick, dramatic achievement. Unfortunately, there's a lot to be settled, and stability in Afghanistan remains an open question to a certain extent. But they feel that the dramatic picture that Afghanistan was created some momentum for applying a similar model to Iraq, and with that momentum, obviously, the goal of regime change.
And we heard repeatedly last fall that what we were seeing played out over Afghanistan was a new model for the application of U.S. military force around the world. Surely there's some truth in that, but you say that many circumstances that the U.S. would face in Iraq are starkly different. Run through those with us.
Well, you've got a number of differences, but I think they're very important ones. First and foremost, there are force ratio problems.
Force ratio, meaning?
The disparity of force between the two sides.
All right.
In Afghanistan, you essentially had a 2-to-1 force ratio. You had about 50,000 Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters set against roughly 25,000 Northern Alliance troops.
Mm-hmm.
They had fought a pitched battle for 7 years in which the Northern Alliance suffered from attrition, but nevertheless were capable of fighting the Taliban to a standstill. And so what happened there was that American special forces could come in and help coordinate a very effective ground or air war, And that was capable of shifting the weight of the pendulum to one side.
You write around Afghanistan that, as you say, local opposition to the Taliban had already over many years fought to a standoff, essentially, and that all we needed to do was apply U.S. military power to tip the balance in favor of the anti-Taliban forces.
That's right. The special forces directing, as I said, a very effective air campaign proved to be the lever that essentially shifted the decisive weight.
We hear that Iraq also has plenty of opposition from Kurds, from Shiite Muslims, from Iraqi exiles outside of the country.
They do, but again, there's some very drastic differences. First and foremost, you have the actual difference in numbers. The Iraqi military is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 375,000 men, where the disparate opposition forces inside Iraq come in around the range of 31,000 to 40,000 troops.
So instead of 2-to-1, you've got a 10-to-1 ratio?
Yeah, something like that, maybe even closer to 14-to-1, although I don't think that that's really how it would play out.
And but by that you mean something like 10 or a dozen to 1, meaning 10 Iraqi or Saddam troops for every one opposition troop on the ground?
Exactly, exactly. And I think that you know, after you saw some defections, which are most certainly likely, and after you see a number of Iraqi troops lay down their weapons and simply make the choice not to fight, mm-hmm. you're still going to see a force ratio of somewhere around 4-1, which is still, the odds are pretty dramatically set against you in a 4-1 fight.
So that would be 4 troops on the side of Saddam, hypothetically, for every 1 opposed. Would U.S. air power, guided by special U.S. Special Forces troops on the ground, be enough to tip the balance in that case, as it was in Afghanistan?
I don't think so. I think in that case, they would not be capable of tipping the balance. And here, I think certain other things come into play. First of all, in the first Desert Storm operation, mm-hmm. The Iraqis did what essentially the Taliban did just a few months ago, and that was fight a pitched battle with entrenched infantry out in the open. And obviously we know the consequences for that when American air power comes to play. I think in this instance, you would have, say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 Iraqi troops conceivably going into the urban environments and creating an urban combat situation where they wouldn't present an open target to American air power.
So they'd be dug in right in the midst of civilian populations, potentially, among mosques and hospitals and schools and civilian neighborhoods.
That's right. That's right.
So even with that, though, how would you compare the Northern Alliance as an on-the-ground ally to U.S. forces to the Iraqi opposition forces, Kurds and Shiites?
Good question. Very, very different force. The Northern Alliance essentially had some kind of offensive capabilities. They were fighting a to-and-fro battle with the Taliban, and they had certain offensive capabilities that were not dissimilar to their opponent. In the case of Iraq, the INC or the Iraqi National Congress is not the Northern Alliance. They have very few talented or capable field commanders, any field commanders with any kind of demonstrated track record. They're an umbrella group for a number of disparate organizations that do not necessarily see eye to eye. Then you have the Kurds in the north. Mm-hmm. Here we have two predominant factions, the PUK and the KDP.
And the Kurds, of course, the ethnic group bitterly opposed to rule by Saddam Hussein, but also an ethnic group that spreads into Turkey, where their independence is looked on with great skepticism by the central government of Turkey, a strong ally of the United States.
This is right. And you also have similar issues with Iran, because the Kurds also straddle that border. Here, the two main Kurdish groups do have a substantial number of armed men, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 30,000. But in this case, these men have predominantly been armed in a way as to allow them to effectively defend themselves. They are not an offensive force. They don't maintain heavy weapons. They don't have mobility capability. Again, they don't have adequate field commanders for a task like this.
So can you see them marching on Baghdad as the Northern Alliance marched on Mazar-e-Sharif and Kabul?
I can't, and I think that's a real recipe for disaster, because something like that, essentially you're envisioning a finite group of Kurds, perhaps supported by American special forces, trying to project their way into Iraqi territory, where I think you have the potential of being surrounded, and air power alone may not be enough to save these
guys. But what about that, Michael Donovan? What if the carpet laid down by American bombs is so dense that the Kurds, and perhaps the Shiite forces as well, could waltz into Baghdad? Is that possible?
Well, it's possible as long as the Iraqis do what they did last time, which is as I said, fight a fixed battle with entrenched infantry. But again, you're coming back to the urban environment. You're asking essentially unprofessional soldiers to try to go into a urban environment and fight professional soldiers, whom, by the way, they outnumber. Mm-hmm. I think it's a potential recipe for disaster.
Michael Donovan, you also look back to the Gulf War in 1991 when George Bush's father applied American bombing. And as I read you, you're surmising that George Bush, the current president, may not have the same latitude to endlessly bomb as his father did. Why not?
Well, this is another important point. I think conceivably, if you're going to try to eliminate the Iraqi forces on the ground simply through preponderance of air power, you could be talking about as many as 80 to 100,000 sorties. Now, 10 years ago, when we bombed extensively Iraqi positions, the television news every night was carrying increasingly dramatic pictures of the damage we were causing. And this was something that was beginning to play upon the minds, I think, of our coalition partners, but also the administration.
Even when that damage was to Iraqi troops.
That's right, but I think it was clear that, first of all, I'm sure there were also collateral casualties, but I think it was clear that you were beginning to see just a preponderance of air power being called in to essentially punish retreating rank-and-file Iraqis. We had repeatedly stated that this was not a war necessarily against the Iraqi people. This is a war against Saddam Hussein.
But even in the Gulf War, you're saying there was some kind of moral restraint eventually required. We all remember the highway of death leading out of Kuwait. It just didn't look good after a while, even when the world was lined up essentially behind the United States.
Exactly. The highway of death is really a case in point. There were dramatic images from that engagement, and it really began to play upon the minds of Bush and his advisors who were concerned, and I think correctly concerned, that our coalition partners were and possibly the American public, their political support for this campaign would begin to dwindle the more those pictures reached an audience.
So, Michael Donald, let me circle back to the beginning. Surely you're not alone in this analysis. Why, then, do you think we've heard the Afghanistan model praised so fulsomely out of Washington if we know many planners don't think that will be enough to get the job done?
Well, I think that at least early on, and I'm not prepared to say where it stands now, but I think at least early on, the Afghan model, as I said, had powerful political supporters here in Washington, particularly among some of the ardent advocates of a regime change in the administration, also among some ex-military men who had worked closely with the Iraqi National Congress in the last decade. They believed, I think, that the possibility of selling regime change became more likely if you sold the possibility of a quick and easy victory in Iraq.
We read Michael O'Hanlon writing just in the last week that it looks more like it will take 250,000 U.S. troops in place to effectively make war on Iraq, that would take that plus the material required to support them would take at least 90 days, so that if George Bush wants to go to war this winter and not get into another summer when it's too hot to fight, that he'd have to pull the trigger on sending out the troops and supplies by November, and it would be a 250,000 troops at least. Does that make sense to your mind?
It does make sense to my mind. I've heard some other theories being bandied about, something like 90 to 100,000 troops. But I think that Michael Hanlon is right on. I think that you're talking about putting about 250,000 pair of boots on the ground in Iraq if you're going to do this.
How does that compare to the Gulf War? And how does 80 to 100,000 bombing sorties compare to the Gulf War?
Well, to answer your first question, you're essentially deploying a force that a lot of people have dubbed Gulf War Light. It's about half the size of the force we deployed in the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. I think that most people or most analysts I talk to tend to believe that that's appropriate given a combination of advances in American military capabilities and the corresponding sort of deprivation that the Iraqi military has gone under. I don't know off the top of my head, and I should, exactly how many sorties we flew during
the Gulf
War.
But we know it was a lot. Michael Donovan, we've got to take a break. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the Afghanistan model for war and Iraq. Does the Afghan rout make Washington too confident in Iraq, too cocky? Is America prepared for the kind of war Iraq might produce? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Afghanistan model for war and Iraq. And the question is America prepared for the kind of war Iraq might produce? Are we prepared this time for body bags and urban warfare? Or despite the differences between Iraq and Afghanistan, are you confident the U.S. military will mop the floor with Iraq's army? Are we too strong to worry? Is worry just a waste of time? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Michael Donovan. He's a research analyst and member of the Terrorism Project at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. You're welcome to join us as well. Imran is on the line right now. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to say that in comparing the two scenarios, I think it's kind of like we're counting our chickens before they've hatched.
In what sense, Imran?
Well, Afghanistan, I don't think it's actually been proven yet that it was a success. I mean, the Taliban, yeah, we threw them out, but we still haven't caught Osama bin Laden or Mullah Omar or any of the other key operatives to Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that we were successful. And the other point I wanted to actually is a question I wanted to ask, and that was that I seem to remember Paul Kennedy in his book, Rise and Fall of Great Empires, makes the point that, you know, every great empire basically, its demise is kind of overextending its military and its economic wherewithal. And if we're talking about putting 250,000 troops in Iraq in a time of recession when the markets aren't doing so good, are we kind of going down that step that Paul Kennedy kind of outlined?
But Imran, what if there's a nuclear bomb in the making in Iraq, as Vice President Cheney warned last week and Donald Rumsfeld suggested again today?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, I hear conflicting things. I mean, you listen to Scott Ritter talk, and he has an opposite opinion. And I think that when you look at the two sources of information, the State Department versus I guess the Pentagon, you have to wonder who's really right.
Imran, thanks for your call. Let me put these to Michael Donovan. Michael Donovan, the first things first. Imran says, don't count your chickens before they hatch in Afghanistan. Was it really such a success after all? Can we put it in the triumphant model category yet?
I think the caller makes a fantastic point, and one I tried to allude to earlier when I said that Afghanistan really constitutes a half victory at this point. Militarily, no question. I think that you can't quabble with the feat that Afghanistan represents, especially when you compare it to the Soviet invasion and what that entailed 10 years or 20 years earlier. However, as I said, I think that stability in Afghanistan remains an open question. There are a lot of bad guys that remain at large, and it remains to be seen whether or not Afghanistan is, in the long run, going to end up a better place than where we found it a year ago. But
so
I think it also raises an interesting point about fighting wars with proxies, because a lot of the bad guys may have flown to freedom, flown the coup during the battle for Kandahar.
Proxies, the Northern Alliance, weren't able or didn't pull the noose tight enough, quick enough.
That's correct. And there may have been some sort of under-the-table deals being made. Essentially, I think that the city was traded for safe passage of these guys out of the city. If there had been substantial number of Western or American troops surrounding Kandahar, you know, there could have been a different story there.
So these may be some flaws in the model. What about the larger question raised here, the decline of empire question? Is the hyperpower, the United States, too big for its britches in imagining that it can handily take on Iraq? Or is this just exactly what the superpower should be doing, taking responsibility for circumstances in the world, as George Bush and his administration like to frame it?
Well, it's a very interesting question, and I suspect one that historians will debate long after this conversation ends. I think that in terms of sort of the economic overreach, that's not something that necessarily concerns me, although I think Americans need to be prepared for some truly staggering numbers.
Gulf War cost $60 billion, and we didn't have to pay at that time.
That's right. That's right. That will almost certainly not be the case this time. And we're also talking about a commitment that I think will almost certainly have to be made in terms of rebuilding the financial economic infrastructure of Iraq. I think that the paramount goal has to be integrating Iraq back into the community of nations as a responsible member, mm-hmm. not simply going in, imposing a new general, and then walking away.
Imran, thanks for your call. We're talking about the Afghanistan model for war and Iraq. If Iraqi opposition forces are weak allies, are you ready for American boys to fight house to house in Baghdad? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Matt's on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
I noticed earlier you were talking about a number of troops, a number of air sorties, mm-hmm. so forth. I think that there's been a lack of mention of how much time this will take. I'm a Gulf War veteran. We had an objective, and that was to expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait.
And it was the famous 100-day war.
It was indeed. I think that this is going to be far from 100 days.
Why do you think so, Matt? You were there. Why longer this time?
Because we expelled the Iraqi forces that were in Kuwait into Shiite-controlled areas. They fled, basically. They withdrew. As we, if we go in there and have to push them into Sunni-controlled areas, including Baghdad, mm-hmm. as you just said, mm-hmm. are we willing to have our boys out there fighting door-to-door in Baghdad?
But, Matt, what about the notion, and it's very popular, and one longs for it if we're going to have such a war, that Saddam's troops might just fold, that they just might walk out and throw down their arms and let the old bad guy fend for himself?
Tom, flip the quarter. Call it.
Yeah, it's a lot to play odds on, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So thanks for my comment, and thanks for the show.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for calling. Michael Donovan, what about it? What kind of time investment are we talking about? Is this another 100-day engagement? Is it 10 days? Do the Iraqis simply say, okay, we get it, we're done?
Well, I think that to do it right and to do it responsibly, it's going to be an engagement that takes as long as it takes. I'm with you. I want to be optimistic, and there's a certain section of my gut that is reserved for praying that the Iraqi army will largely dissolve and vote with their feet. And I do think that that's a possibility. Let's not forget last time that we had members of the Iraqi military essentially surrendering faster than we could establish the facilities to take them prisoner with. Mm-hmm. In some cases, you had members of the Iraqi military surrendering to reporters. I think that you can count on one hand the number of people in Iraq that are willing to die for Saddam Hussein. Unfortunately, there will be, and that's hyperbole, obviously, and there will be, I suspect, a hardcore element that will take to the cities. And Saddam, during the first Gulf War, fought a political war. When he decided that the jig was up, those troops weren't just running willy-nilly. They were running back to Baghdad because he wanted to maintain his crack troops to preserve the regime.
That is, to defend the center. Listeners, we're talking tonight about the Afghanistan model for war and Iraq. Have the 100-day Gulf War and the Taliban's flight made Americans see war as painless, as no problem, as long as we win quick? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Tim's calling from Hollis, New Hampshire. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Good evening. I'm actually a Brit, but I live over here now, so I see even both sides.
We'll put up with you.
I know. I appreciate that. I have a suggestion for a program in about 6 months' time after this war has happened. We should invite our guests back for a Why I Didn't Tell You So session.
And what would the I Told You So be?
Well, every skirmish I can think of for the last 25 years, I mean, count them off. Kosovo.
Yes.
Milosevic was never going to give up. The guy was a complete tyrant and ruled the country with a rod of iron. His men were all psychopaths. Uh-huh. It would be a bloodbath, thousands of bodies. The Afghanistanis, until about, 5 months ago,
yep.
were each one was a one-man army.
We heard all about the British dying in the snows of Kabul.
Exactly, yeah. They killed us in Kabul, and they were going to take the Americans out by the thousand mm-hmm. each per person. I'm frankly tired of this.
So what do you think's going on here, Tim? You're saying the U.S. forces are powerful. Why do we talk ourselves to death about it?
It's a post-Vietnam American paranoia. The Brits, God bless them, when they get involved in this stuff, don't engage in the same thing. Yeah, there are one or two leftists that troll out in Parliament each time. Tony Benn is a classic case of this. And he did the 10,000 body bags per enemy last time. Mm-hmm. Credit to him, that's their job. But basically, Brits regard the army as an occupational hazard. Getting killed is an occupational hazard, I'm ashamed to say, or maybe sad to say, of a military guy. You sign up, and you sign, and there is a cost associated with that. We are not
Yes, there is, and we know. Tim, hold on. I want to put it to Michael Donovan. Michael Donovan, what about it? Tim points to Bosnia, the Gulf War, Afghanistan. You could add Panama, Haiti, Grenada, and says, what's the big problem here? The U.S. Army has, or military has a track record now of getting in and getting out.
As I said, I have an instinct as well that we may be facing a paper tiger here. The problem is the instincts are not something that you can plan on. You have to plan on the contingency that 100,000 Republican Guard are going to take to the cities and fight tooth and nail for every inch. And planning on anything less is reckless.
And what about Tim's point, Michael Donovan, that there's too much American wringing of hands over this? Do you share that view? Do you think that the potential war with Iraq has been sufficiently debated, over-debated? What's your assessment?
I don't think that in a democracy you can over-debate something as serious as this. I think that we've seen the poll numbers begin to drop for those Americans who support action in Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think that whether or not dying is an occupational hazard of a soldier, I think that a democracy owes it to itself to ensure that it's deploying its soldiers for the right reasons and in the right way.
We saw over the weekend an LA Times poll that found 59% of Americans prepared for war with Iraq or in favor of it, though I guess more than half of those, as I recall, wanted it to go through a United Nations blessing before it kicked into gear.
Yeah, you're seeing the numbers, I think, are proving to be soft, depending on the kind of questions you ask the American people. And I think that one of the things that at least enheartens me a little bit is that you are seeing more of an interest among Americans for trying to explore some multilateral alternatives to just America as the lone gun in Iraq.
Tim, thank you for your call. Fred's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. My question is this. Who would we, the United States, really be attacking in Iraq in order to depose Saddam Hussein? Is the theory that by attacking his 25,000-man army in Baghdad that the regime would collapse because that's how Saddam governs? He just governs with an iron will. If there's a political motive or if he governs within a political agenda, I guess, if Saddam Hussein sent the army guarding Baghdad out and there was nobody to attack, all he would have to do is play a shell game, and in theory he could still govern. I guess that's my real question. What would we be attacking in order to get rid of Saddam?
That is a great question, and thanks for raising it, Fred. And I guess there's a couple of ways of looking at that, Michael Donovan. First of all, who exactly do you have to attack Saddam? How dense is the apparatus around him? Are the loyalties around him? And Fred's second question kind of goes to the scenario, could Saddam turn into a second Osama bin Laden? Might he join bin Laden in a cave uncaught and still a threat?
Two very good questions. I think the first question, I think typically American military planners are looking at a range of targets. Certainly on the first night or so, you're going to go after all the high-value, high-profile targets you can find.
Yeah, but you mean physical targets in that case, munitions
well,
dumps,
these,
power plants, I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that some of these are going to include leadership targets, what the military calls leadership targets.
But who is so wired into Saddam Hussein that they cannot desert him, that they must be defeated to defeat him?
Well, there are some people that are wired in, as you put it. Saddam has been very good at spreading the guilt around. He has co-opted a lot of the Tikriti Mafia, is what they're called.
This is his hometown, Tikrit.
That's right, and there's some of the Sunni tribal elites that he has surrounded himself with. These people share guilt with all the crimes of the Iraqi police state. And so they realize that whatever alternative presents itself in a post-Saddam Iraq, they're going to be on the losing end.
So they might as well go down fighting.
These are the guys that are going to fight hard. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that some of the thinking falls along the lines of really punishing the Iraqi military in the first several days, in the hopes that you precipitate some kind of regime change from within, mm-hmm. By guys who realize that the writing is on the wall.
And could Saddam be a threat in a cave on the run?
Well, that's an interesting question. We obviously found it difficult to track down Osama bin Laden. I think it may be less easy for Saddam to hide in Iraq than it was for Osama bin Laden to hide in the tribal badlands of the Pakistani-Afghan mm-hmm. border. Mm-hmm. This being said, I read a very interesting interview that was done in 1992 on the BBC, in which the interviewee said, look, there are all sorts of problems with prosecuting the war all the way to Baghdad. One of the biggest is finding Saddam, and the other major one is how long do we have to stay and what's it going to cost to prop up a regime? And the interviewee was Dick Cheney.
We know that even in Panama, it wasn't so easy to instantly find Manuel Noriega, even in that small country. Let's try and get one more call. Jack's calling from Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. When we hear discussions about this, we don't hear about the morality, about the precedent set. When a mm-hmm. country perceives a threat from another, they invade. Mm-hmm. This can happen all over the world. Whenever the only reason we didn't attack Russia was we knew they were going to wipe us out, so they had this mutually assured destruction. I think we're just being bullies. We're not examining any alternatives.
So it's too quick to just talk logistics. You want a bigger debate on the moral angle, Jack.
I think so.
Michael Donovan, Jack, thank you for your call. Michael Donovan, how about it? I guess both from a purely moral point of view and from a military point of view, it does matter to appear to have right on one side if one goes to war. And it matters in deciding whether to go to war. How do you see that discussion standing? Is that discussion sufficient?
Well, I think it's a discussion that many Americans and almost the entire rest of the world is waiting to see started in earnest. I don't think that the administration has made a case. I'm not entirely sold on the necessity of this either. Although for me, it's increasingly appears to me that invading Iraq may be the best of several really bad policy options.
Michael Donovan, we only have a few seconds left. Handicap it for us. George Bush says he hasn't decided. Will we or will we not go to war with Iraq?
Oh, you put me on the spot.
Yes.
You know what? I'll tell you in November, you'll see it all telegraphed.
Okay.
If it happens, you'll see it from a long way away.
We'll know then. Michael Donovan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Michael Donovan is research analyst and member of the Terrorism Project at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. After the break, Afghanistan correspondent Sarah Chase fills us in on the realities of life in post-war Afghanistan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Over the past several months, On Point's Afghanistan correspondent, Sarah Chase, has been bringing us voices, sounds, and stories from the Afghan street. A former NPR reporter, she's now based in Kandahar and works for the NGO Afghans for Civil Society. Last week, Sarah Chase was back in the United States. I asked her to describe the security situation in her Afghan base, Kandahar.
I think people feel less safe than they have in the past. There's a feeling of insecurity, or people will talk about insecurity. They talk about robberies being up, and in particular robberies by people in uniform, police officers or something like that, who will come in and say they're entering a house to search for arms or something like that, and then they'll tie up the house owners and make off with the stuff.
Doesn't sound good. Is it chaos?
It's not chaos or mayhem. I feel, strangely, here I am, female and American, in what many many consider to be one of the hottest parts of Afghanistan, and I feel completely safe. Now,
the fact that NGO workers have been attacked in recent months in Mazar-e-Sharif?
Yeah, it's a very different situation in Mazar-e-Sharif. And in Kandahar, there haven't been any such attacks. I think risk is something that has to be looked at rationally. You can't make risk disappear, but you can calculate and reduce it. And I actually think that in a country like Afghanistan, your protection is with the people. That doesn't mean it's guaranteed. I would never go anywhere alone or where I didn't have someone with me who knew people in the area so that I was then seen as under the protection of somebody. That's how things work in southern
Afghanistan.
You've
got to be smart. Are people armed in the streets?
Yeah, but most of them now are police or sort of members of the kind of personal militias that belong to certain commanders or warlords. There are a lot of checkpoints. There's a curfew at night, which is extremely well respected.
And what is the civilian authority, or is there a civilian authority in charge? Who's running Kandahar?
Who's running Kandahar is a guy called Gulagha Shirzai, and he is a warlord. He was governor of Kandahar province before the Taliban came to power and is one of the reasons they were welcomed in the south, because on his watch, it was mayhem. Back then, it really was mayhem. There were chains across the main road going down to Pakistan, and you could be robbed, you could be murdered, you could be murdered before you were robbed, you could be raped.
Any combination.
You know, anything. That's right. In the time that I've spent in the region during and after the conflict, everyone's concern was that once the Taliban were gone, that reign of terror would return.
And even from our perspective here in the United States, it looks like there's a kind of power contest going on between central authority and warlords. Do you see that playing out in your own town?
Very much so. And sometimes it has come nearly to blows between, you know, representatives of the central authority and this local governor, who has a lot of independent resources. And that's one of the main problems now in Afghanistan.
Resources as in troops or as in economic resources or both?
Both. He's got troops, and those troops are secured by economic resources. And he gets those from a variety of sources. One is south of the border, which means Pakistan. One is the border itself. No customs receipts have gone to Kabul, either since the end of the Taliban regime or even since the Loya Jirga, which put in place an official transitional government.
So duties are being charged and taxes, but it's going into the warlord's pocket.
Correct. The amount of money that is being collected from various sources by Governor Shirzai would be sufficient to begin some really serious projects for the common benefit, like cleaning up the roads. I mean, some very basic human services. There's enough money in that town now to provide for those services, and it's not being done.
Why not?
Because of this different conception of government that you're talking about, that government really is seen as the personal exercise of power.
By the warlords, in this case, Kandahar's warlord.
Exactly. And then the splitting of the spoils of that power among his men.
This doesn't sound sustainable. Does Gulagha Shirzai feel pressure from any source to act in a more civic-minded way, from the central government, from American authorities of some kind, from the UN, from anyone?
Well, here's the problem, is that American authorities are kind of presenting almost a split policy. In other words, there is a stated desire that Afghanistan become stabilized and become more civic-minded and all that kind of thing. And then meanwhile, other parts of the American governing apparatus are paying people like Gulagha Shirzai and their men to ostensibly hunt for remnants of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and other services. So you really have a totally mixed message coming out of the United States,
where the U.S. talks high ideals but then is in cahoots or cooperating with the warlord and his troops.
Precisely.
Does anyone have a vision that's being forcefully articulated of how Afghanistan can move through this kind of warlord principalities status and into a civic-oriented nation? Is there a path that's been described or that someone's pushing?
No. And the people, I think, are way ahead of the governments both in Afghanistan and outside Afghanistan. In other words, you will hear American pundits saying, oh, Afghanistan has always been sort of semi-tribal, semi-feudal principalities. It's going to be that way. You even hear some members of the U.S. administration arguing that that's, quote-unquote, the best you could hope for in Afghanistan or something like that. that country has lived through such bloodbath that even those who do have a vision of a united Afghanistan under good governance and where the common weal is the guiding principle are extremely concerned, and perhaps I believe even maybe too concerned, about going too quickly because they're afraid that one false move could lead
bring
to
it all down.
Exactly.
You were going to say civil war.
Right.
Does that feel like a possibility in the air in your corner of Afghanistan?
I don't think so. And I don't know whether the feeling in Kandahar is artificial because of the presence, albeit silent presence, of U.S. troops or not, or whether it is a fair litmus test. I mean, it's true that there are 5,000 U.S. troops. They're not very visible, but they're there in Kandahar. And many people in Kandahar say their presence there is what's keeping the place from blowing open. But my sense from all the talking to people that I've done is that the people are champing at the bit for this to happen, and that if the central government could come up with a way...
For the evolution of a civic life.
Exactly. And for people to be held accountable, and I mean, governing leaders, to be held accountable. This is the army. This is the real army. It's the people of Afghanistan.
Empower them, and you don't have to have a soldier on every corner.
Well, and empower them, and you can defeat the soldiers who are on every corner. That's what it feels. Now, you had sort of asked how things feel security-wise and things like that. Now, again, I don't know how much my own position is indicative or not. I mean, I still run around most of the time dressed in guy's clothes. I have even taken to wearing a turban because it's cooler than wearing something thrown all the way over your head and shoulders.
Do you mean to say you're just taking an American woman's liberties and wearing blue jeans, or you're disguising your gender in guy's clothes?
I'm not disguising my gender, but I'm not wearing blue jeans. I'm wearing Afghan men's clothes. But here's the other thing that I do is I drive. And I'm probably the first or second woman in 30 years to drive in Kandahar. And I drive around, and people love it. I was really surprised. I mean, I get amused and astonished reactions from people, but now my best friends in town are the traffic police. And they wear these white caps, and at every corner, they toot their whistles at me, and we tease each other because they ask for bakshish, they ask for money, and now I've gotten so brazen that I'll ask them for money.
A nod to Ms. Chase. What about American forces, American officials, American troops? You were saying they weren't very visible. What are they doing there? How often do Afghans see them? What's their main function at this point?
The Americans are under enormous constraints that some of their European counterparts are not, meaning Americans, because of the force protection doctrine of U.S. military at the moment, they cannot move around except with six of them in full combat gear.
Because it might make them vulnerable, and that's outside of a reigning theory.
Supposedly. Another theory is that by wearing all of this gear, you are in fact looking hostile and therefore likely to attract hostile reactions. And I've sat with the British Special Forces. I had a barbecue with them, a little squad of theirs, and we had a long conversation about it. And they said, you know, it's crazy. We consciously present a non-hostile, non-threatening profile, and we've never had a problem. So that's one issue with Americans, and the special forces, who are the ones who do get around the most, also are quite aloof from the locals. They kind of, you know, they wear dark glasses and they act the part, let's put it that way.
Don't mess with us.
Right. And as a result, I'm not sure that they reduce tensions.
Is there a civil affairs arm that's having a different kind of interaction?
There is, actually. I've had quite a bit to do with them. And I found that these guys, in spite of their constraints, in spite of the fact that they're Americans in uniform, they have gotten an enormous amount done.
What do they do?
They drill wells. The water table is sinking dramatically in southern Afghanistan.
Because of drought?
Because of drought. There's a whole, again, sort of philosophical issue that maybe we shouldn't drill any more wells until there's some kind of grand strategy, which is fair enough.
Nice to say, unless you're thirsty.
Exactly. In the meantime, there are a bunch of villages that are going to fail, and these guys have been out there, and they've been drilling. They've got another 75 now on their list, and they've also learned a lot about what kinds of wells are the best wells for the area, and they're just methodically doing it. They're building schools, and they've built some clinics. They're extremely imaginative. Also, they've got a lot of other ideas and even sometimes chafe at what they say is sometimes a bit of a narrow
channel. I should ask you about Afghan women. You've described how Afghan civilians in general are hungry for more civic-oriented government. What kind of progress do you see women making? Has their role changed, or are they still in that severely subordinate position? Is there revolution or just status quo?
There's some revolution in that women are in the workplace, in particular in schools, but also in clinics. So that's a major change. But in Kandahar, anyway, I would say 9/10 of the population you see when you're walking through the streets is male. 1/10 of the people walking through the streets will be female, and of those, I would say 90% are wearing not just veil, but burqa, the full head-to-toe blue. Mm-hmm. You know, when we first started out, we didn't plan to run any women's programs because that seemed to be such a sort of hot topic, mm-hmm. you know, and it seemed...
Might get you alienated from the community, you mean?
Yeah, not... No, I don't mean that kind of hot. I mean, it was like too popular.
Oh, I see.
On
too
this
fashionable.
Side. Fashionable. And then it sort of presented itself to us. And in the following guise, there were women delegates to the Loya Jirga, mm-hmm. which was this big gathering of elected representatives to choose the current transitional government. And in Kandahar, there were 5. And somebody asked us to get together some leading women. And so I immediately went to the 5 Loya Jirga delegates and a couple of others. And then it turns out that these women have never been brought together since the Loya Jirga for any matter of substance. Mm-hmm. They're always called upon to go to all the city ceremonies and provincial speechifying and all that kind of thing.
But nothing that mattered.
Exactly. And they were absolutely thrilled to be brought together just to sort of talk about what some of the issues are and what some of their priorities are.
And what do they say? Are things changing or they're waiting for change?
They are waiting for change and they're waiting for some understanding that their concerns are best represented by themselves and that men aren't necessarily going to make the best case for women's concerns. And what's very interesting is a lot of those concerns are exactly what you'd hear American working women talking about, like daycare. Biggest one is daycare.
Right.
Next one is transportation, because, again, whether or not the security concern is real.
How do we safely get around and feel safe getting around?
It's feel safe. I don't feel like I'm in a position to be able to say to them, look, you really are safe. They don't feel safe. And that's what matters, as far as I'm concerned.
Does it feel like an improvement for them over the Taliban years?
It is an improvement, because they're not being beaten. They are allowed to go out. They can ride in rickshaws by themselves and all that kind of thing. But they do still feel under pressure. There are small things, like the women teachers in a number of schools have to wear uniforms, and that uniform is visible under the burqa. Mm-hmm. And so they are picked out as teachers, and then they will be subject to harassment in the streets and things like that. So they want public transportation, and they want health. Again, because their mobility is still limited, they need really neighborhood health clinics, and they need them to be open at night. And that's a big problem, because there aren't a lot of female health professionals.
Sarah, there's clearly so much to be done here. You're in the midst of it. Are you hopeful?
Somebody I was working with recently turned to me with a smile and said, this is like trying to clean up a nuclear disaster with a toothbrush. But you have to keep doing it. I don't know how to answer that question, because rationally, I would have to say the odds against are enormous, are too high. And at the same time, I do feel like there's a chance. And it's one of the first of these kinds of situations that I've been in where I have felt there's a chance. And I do feel like there really are people who could make something out of this country. But I think we have to take on board that when a whole society has been subjected to major trauma for 20 to 30 years, it's going to take a long time for the seeds of anything constructive and positive to begin to take root. This is a group of people that quite legitimately has a very hard time bonding emotionally, mm-hmm. that has a very hard time thinking ahead in the sense of husbanding resources. So they are people who do tend to like
grab it now. Mm-hmm.
That's it. And that can make us really irritated and angry and frustrated. And
but
I
it won't go away overnight.
Yeah, that's it.
Sarah Chase, it's always so good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Chase contributes to On Point from Afghanistan. She worked for the NGO Afghans for Civil Society and is based in Kandahar. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.